This CLE course is based upon the negligence-related decisions from February 2019, released by our appellate courts that month. And the summaries included in the written materials were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in February, and they are now compiled in an organized pamphlet, which is available on the site and which is being used as the written materials for this CLE. The first case is an assumption of risk case. It's on page 6, Alvarado. The plaintiff was playing basketball on an outside basketball court that he had played on many times before. There was a crack in the tar surface, and grass was growing out of the crack. And the court ruled, the first department, that he had assumed the risk of injury from the crack. The court said, defendant made a prima facie showing of its entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by submitting evidence that plaintiff frequently played basketball on the outdoor basketball court, which had an open and obvious crack running the length of the court. The court correctly rejected plaintiff's contention that grass growing out of the crack concealed its depth, finding instead that the grass served to highlight the defect, which was also one of the risks assumed by plaintiff when he played basketball on that court. The next case is the Sugamele case, S-U-G-A-M-E-L-E, on pages 6 and 7. It's a boating accident case involving municipal law, and it also involves the maritime law, which is rare. There was a fatal boating accident, and the town was sued based on its placement of buoys in the area where the accident occurred. The Second Department reversed the Supreme Court and found that the town was not entitled to summary judgment. Four boat passengers were killed and others were injured, and the complaint alleged that the town was negligent in the placement of buoys. The court wrote, maritime law, which is applicable in this case, recognizes a general theory of liability for negligence. It quotes, negligent conduct on the navigable waters that causes loss to another constitutes a maritime tort. Once the town set a channel through the use of navigational aids, it had a duty to maintain those navigational aids in a reasonable and prudent manner. The next case is the Fitzsimmons or Fitzsimons case on pages 6 and 7. It's a lawsuit against a college brought by the estates of two students, college students, who were killed in an off-campus house fire. And the off-campus house was on a list provided to the students by the college, a list of available off-campus housing, private housing. The court wrote, the threshold question in any negligence action is, does defendant owe a legally recognized duty of care to the plaintiff? In the context of this action, a critical consideration in determining whether such a duty exists is whether Marist College's relationship with either the Brennans, that's the homeowners, or the students, Carrie and Eva, place the college in the best position to protect against the risk of harm. Also relevant is the principle that one who assumes to act, even though gratuitously, may thereby become subject to the duty of acting carefully. Marist College did not owe a duty of care to Carrie and Eva. Contrary to the plaintiff's argument, Marist College demonstrated that it did not owe a duty to ensure that the off-campus housing listed on its website, which included the Brennan House, complied with all relevant fire safety rules. Even if, in theory, Marist College could have refused to list landlords on its website unless each landlord's off-campus housing met all relevant fire safety laws and regulations. Imposing such a requirement on the college is simply not warranted because the college is not in the best position to protect against the risk of harm. Next case is KA versus the City of New York on page 8. It involves education, school law, and municipal law. The court found that the city did owe a special duty to a student who was struck by a car attempting to cross the road after school, but it also held that that duty was fulfilled when the crossing guard told the student to walk to the next available crosswalk. As the court put it, a special duty existed between the city defendant's crossing guard and the infant plaintiff. Given that the crossing guard told the infant plaintiff not to cross 7th Avenue at an unsafe location and pointed the infant plaintiff to the crosswalk at 19th Street, the city defendants established that its employees did not breach their duty to the infant plaintiff. In addition, the city defendants, while under a duty to adequately supervise the students in their charge, are not insurers of their safety. The evidence submitted by the city established that the infant plaintiff crossed 7th Avenue in the middle of the block where there was no intersection or crosswalk and no traffic device affording her a right of way. The infant plaintiff admitted that she attempted to cross the road fast and that she didn't look for oncoming traffic. Where an accident occurs so quickly that even the most intense supervision could not have prevented it, any lack of supervision is not the proximate cause of injury. Next is the Boland case on page 9. This is another case, another lawsuit against a school, this time for an injury which occurred on the playground with playground equipment. And the second department held that the negligent maintenance cause of action properly survived summary judgment. And it also held that the negligent supervision cause of action was properly dismissed. The court wrote, "The plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact by the submission of her expert's affidavit, which opined in part that the ground cover beneath the apparatus from which plaintiff fell was inherently dangerous as installed and or maintained because it did not meet standards established by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and it cites General Business Law Section 399-DD. In another education school law case, it's the Powers versus Greenville Central School District on page 10. This is another supervision action. The third department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the school district's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted in this lacrosse injury case. There were questions of fact about the type of sticks and balls used such that protective goggles may have been required. The court wrote, "We find that a triable issue of fact exists as to the nature of the lacrosse game played by the students and whether protective goggles should have been used by the students based upon the game they were playing. Under the circumstances, a jury must determine whether defendants' breach of their duty to provide protective goggles was a proximate cause of the student's eye injury." The Clifford case on pages 10 and 11 is a medical malpractice case, and it involves the continuous treatment doctrine. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the action should not have been dismissed as untimely. Plaintiff raised questions of fact supporting the application of the continuous treatment toll of the statute of limitations. The court noted that the fact that plaintiff may have considered bringing a malpractice action during the course of her treatment did not signal the termination of the treatment. And although the lawsuit named the surgeon, who was named Cates, who did the hip replacement, the suit also encompassed treatment by others at the clinic, treatment that was well within the statute of limitations. The court said, even though plaintiff was somewhat disaffected with Cates, the record does not conclusively establish that either plaintiff or Cates regarded the gap in treatment or plaintiff's consultation with counsel as the end of their treatment relationship. We therefore cannot conclude that the continuous treatment doctrine no longer applied as a matter of law based on that consultation with a lawyer. The next case on pages 11 and 12, Simpson, it's another medical malpractice case, this time involving the adequacy of the plaintiff's expert affidavit in the context of a summary judgment motion. The Second Department reversed Supreme Court and determined that defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Plaintiff was treated by an ophthalmologist for an eye pain. The doctor suspected glaucoma. 6 months later, the plaintiff was diagnosed with meningioma, a non-cancerous tumor of the membrane surrounding the brain. Plaintiff's expert did not lay a foundation for an opinion that meningioma could have been treated with radiation rather than surgery had it been discovered earlier. The court said, while it is true that a medical expert need not be a specialist in a particular field in order to testify regarding accepted practices in that field, the witness nonetheless should be possessed of the requisite skill, training, education, knowledge, or experience from which it can be assumed that the opinion rendered is reliable. Where a physician opines outside his or her area of specialization, a foundation must be laid tending to support the reliability of the opinion rendered. Here, plaintiff's expert, who was board certified in ophthalmology, was qualified to and did raise a triable issue of fact as to whether defendants deviated from the accepted standard of care in failing to refer the plaintiff to a neurologist to further evaluate his symptoms. But the affidavit was insufficient to establish that the plaintiff's meningioma could have been treated by radiation instead of surgery if it had been detected earlier. The plaintiff's expert failed to articulate that he had any training in the treatment of meningiomas or what, if anything, he did to familiarize himself with the applicable standard of care. The affidavit lacked probative value, failed to raise a triable issue of fact as to whether any departure from the accepted standard of care proximately caused the plaintiff's injuries. Next case, J.H. versus New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation on pages 12 and 13. It's another medical malpractice case, this time brought against a municipality. Therefore, a notice of claim was required. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion to deem a late notice of claim timely served should have been granted. The attempt to serve the notice of claim was 3 years late. Plaintiff, who was born in 2010, brought a medical malpractice action alleging the city hospital was negligent by sending plaintiff's mother home when she presented at the emergency room complaining of contractions. The Second Department held that the medical records provided the defendant with timely knowledge of the nature of the claim. The court said, the medical records demonstrated that the hospital failed to admit the plaintiff's mother to the hospital when she presented to an emergency room in November 2010, notwithstanding an order in the emergency room record from a physician that the mother was to be admitted secondary to non-reassuring fetal heart tracing. Inasmuch as the medical records, upon independent review, showed that the mother was not admitted to the hospital in November 2010, despite a physician's order, and that 2 days later the plaintiff was delivered 1 hour after the mother arrived at the hospital and only after a fetal heart monitor alarm sounded 4 times, they provided the hospital with actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim. The plaintiff made an initial showing that the hospital would not suffer any prejudice by the delay in serving a notice of claim, and the hospital failed to rebut the showing with particularized indicia of prejudice. The absence of prejudice was demonstrated by virtue of the fact that the hospital had possessed timely actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim. Next is another lawsuit against a municipality, this time based on police conduct. It's Relf versus City of Troy on pages 13 and 14. The Third Department held that several causes of action properly survived summary judgment. Here, the police officer named Ash released his canine partner, Elsa, which a trained police dog, which bit plaintiff as he was walking to his car. After Elsa was released, she ran out of the police officer's sight. He was attempting to use Elsa to track suspects who had just robbed a gas station. The Third Department held that the 42 U.S.C. 1983 action properly survived summary judgment. Ash also held that Ash was not entitled to qualified immunity as a matter of law, and also that the battery action properly survived summary judgment. Court wrote, there is at least a question of fact as to whether a reasonable police officer, aware that the dog could not differentiate a suspect from an innocent bystander, would allow the dog to search off-leash and out of sight of the handler. The record contains evidence from which a jury could find that the city failed to train its employees in a relevant respect that evidence a deliberate indifference to the rights of its inhabitants, which can be properly thought of as a city policy or custom that is actionable under 42 U.S.C. 1983. Plaintiff's expert opined that Ash failed to comply with standard police practice, including keeping the canine within visual range and providing audible warnings. There are triable issues of fact that preclude summary judgment on the issue of Ash's entitlement to qualified immunity. The court went on to find that the city was entitled to dismissal of the common law negligence claims based on the professional judgment rule. That rule insulates a municipality from liability for its employees' performance of their duties where the conduct involves the exercise of professional judgment, such as electing one among many acceptable methods of carrying out tasks or making tactical decisions. So the action survived against the police officer, but not against the city. Next case is matter of Mercedes versus City of New York, another municipal law case. It's another late notice of claim case. The First Department, reversing the Supreme Court, held that petitioner's application for leave to file a late notice of claim should have been granted. He alleged he was injured by the malfunction of weightlifting equipment at a city recreation center. The court assumed that the excuse for not filing the notice on time was not reasonable, and it wrote, the absence of a reasonable excuse is not standing alone fatal to the application where the municipal respondent had actual notice of the essential facts constituting the claim and was not prejudiced by the delay. Petitioner's affidavit stating that he signed an incident report prepared by respondent's employee shortly after the accident and that the weightlifting equipment was repaired a few months later, demonstrate that respondent received actual notice of the pertinent facts underlying the claim, if not the negligence itself, which supports a plausible argument that the city will not be substantially prejudiced in investigating and defending the claim. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this CLE course based upon the negligence-related decisions from the New York appellate courts, which were released in February 2019 and which were summarized on the New York Appellate Digest website. The verification code is MARITIME, M-A-R-I-T-I-M-E. Again, the verification code for this CLE is MARITIME. Next, we have the George case, which is on page 15. It's a complaint against the foster care agency, and it was found that the complaint stated causes of action for negligent placement in the foster care agency and also for loss of the children's services and expenses for the children's care and treatment. Second Department held that plaintiff, the children's guardian, stated causes of action against the foster care agency, Graham Wyndham, for negligent placement of the children and for loss of services. The court wrote, counties and foster care agencies cannot be vicariously liable for the negligent acts of foster parents, who are essentially contract service providers. However, counties and foster care agencies may be sued to recover damages for negligence in the selection of foster parents and in supervision of the foster home. To sustain a cause of action for negligent supervision, plaintiff must establish that the defendant had sufficiently specific knowledge or notice of the dangerous condition which caused injury, that being that the third-party acts could reasonably have been anticipated. A parent may recover damages measured by the pecuniary loss sustained by the injuries to the child, including the value of the child's services, if any, of which the parent was deprived, and reasonable expenses necessarily incurred in an effort to restore the child to health. The court should not have directed dismissal of so much of the third cause of action, which asserted against the foster care agency Graham Wyndham, as sought to recover damages for the loss of the children's services and the expenses for their care and treatment. The next case on pages 15 and 16, it's an open and obvious dangerous condition case involving a lockbox on the outside of a building. Plaintiff apparently struck his head on the lockbox, and the court found that the lockbox was open and obvious and was not inherently dangerous. Therefore, the defendant's summary judgment motion was properly granted. In Hinton on page 16, it's a Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals, over an extensive dissent by two judges, held that the Village Code provision, which requires written notice of a sidewalk defect before the village can be held liable, applies to a stairway which connected a public road to a municipal parking lot. And because the plaintiff did not plead or prove written notice of a stairway defect, the plaintiff's slip and fall action was properly dismissed. The court wrote, "In Woodson versus City of New York, this court determined a stairway may be classified as a sidewalk for purposes of prior written notice if it functionally fulfills the same purpose that a standard sidewalk would serve. The courts below correctly applied Woodson in holding that the stairway at issue functionally fulfills the same purpose as a standard sidewalk. Therefore, plaintiff was required to show that the village received prior written notice of the allegedly defective condition." Next is the Saris case. It's a spoliation case on page 17. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant's store, Fairway, should not have been sanctioned. Here it was an adverse inference jury instruction for spoliation of evidence, that being a videotape depicting areas outside the store. Plaintiff slipped and fell on ice in an area near the entrance to the store. The videotape from the camera which captured the fall was provided to plaintiff. The videotape from the other cameras depicting other areas outside the store was not preserved. The court said, "The plaintiff's January 2013 letter specifically requested that Fairway preserve any and all video footage depicting the location of my client's accident. 10 hours of video footage depicting the exact location of the accident before the fall, including footage of the accident itself, was preserved by Fairway and subsequently disclosed to plaintiff. The plaintiff did not initially request that video footage of other locations also be preserved, so Fairway was not on notice that such footage might be needed for future litigation." The next case, Rodriguez, stairway fall, slip and fall case. The court found, the second department found that the action should be dismissed because the plaintiff was not able to identify the cause of his slip and fall without engaging in speculation, and that finding was based upon the 50H hearing and the deposition transcripts. In Stepkowski, on pages 18 and 19, another slip and fall case, the second department reversed Supreme Court, finding that the defendants did not demonstrate that they lacked constructive notice of the crumbling asphalt around a sewer grate. The court said, here the evidence submitted in support of the defendant's motion demonstrated that they did not have actual notice of the dangerous condition, but failed to eliminate triable issues of fact as to whether they created the crumbling asphalt condition or whether they had constructive notice of it because it had been there for a sufficient length of time. In Fasano, F-A-S-A-N-O, on page 20, another slip and fall case, the Second Department held that the case properly survived summary judgment motion. The plaintiff had alleged that her foot was caught in a 1-inch gap at the top of exterior stairs. The court wrote that testifying at her deposition, plaintiff identified photographs demonstrating the gap was at least 1 inch wide and at least 1 inch deep and 3 feet long and ran the entire length of the steps. Despite testimony that the defendant's agent did not notice the defect until after the accident, Second Department said, we agree with Supreme Court's finding that defendants failed to establish that the subject steps were not in a defective condition and that the defendants did not have constructive notice, as a reasonable inspection would have revealed the defective condition. Another slip and fall case, Pascari, on pages 20 and 21. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this case should have been granted. The defendant had placed cardboard over the floor opening to the basement in this house, which was under construction. Plaintiff, whose presence was foreseeable and who allegedly was aware of the opening in the floor, fell through and landed on his back on the basement floor. The court said, inasmuch as plaintiff's presence was foreseeable, the risk of serious injury was great, and the burden of avoiding the risk minimal, we conclude that a finding that the defendants were not negligent could not have been reached on any fair interpretation of the evidence. Next case, Palai, P-A-L-A-I. It's a third-party assault case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the manager of a cooperative complex could not be liable for a third-party assault which occurred in an exterior public area. The court wrote, plaintiff and his wife commenced this action to recover for personal injuries he allegedly sustained when he was shot outdoors in the cooperative complex known as Co-op City, which was managed by the defendant. However, a landowner's duty to take minimal security precautions does not extend to exterior public areas such as walkways and vestibules. The Shea case on page 22 is another third-party assault case, but it involves corporation law. The Second Department held that the defendant's security company's motion to dismiss the complaint shouldn't have been granted in this third-party assault case. The complaint alleged the security company's negligence resulted in the murder of plaintiff's decedent, at an assisted living facility. The defendant alleged that it didn't provide security there at the time of the murder, but documentary evidence submitted by the defendant didn't rule out the possibility that the defendant could be liable based upon its relationship with the company which was providing security at the time of the murder. The court wrote, generally, a corporation which acquires the assets of another is not liable for the torts of its predecessor. However, such liability may arise if the successor corporation expressly or impliedly assumed the predecessor's tort liability, or there was a consolidation or merger of seller and purchaser, or the purchaser corporation was a mere continuation of the seller corporation, or the transaction was entered into fraudulently to escape such obligations. The court held that the evidence failed to demonstrate that the exceptions to the general rule of a successor corporation's non-liability, where there was a de facto merger between the purchaser and the seller, or where the purchaser is a mere continuation of the seller do not apply in this case. Next, another third-party assault case, Oblatore, O-B-L-A-T-O-R-E. This is on page 23. Second Department held that the owners of a restaurant, bar, were not liable for an attack on plaintiff in the adjacent parking lot. The court said, landowners, as a general rule, have a duty to exercise reasonable care to prevent harm to patrons on their property. However, an owner's duty to control the conduct of persons on its premises arises only when it has the opportunity to control such conduct and is reasonably aware of the need for such control. The owner of a public establishment has no duty to protect patrons against unforeseeable and unexpected assaults. Here, the defendants established they were entitled to summary judgment by submitting evidence showing that the attack on the plaintiff was unforeseeable and unexpected. Next is an asbestos case, matter of New York City asbestos litigation. It's a Court of Appeals case on pages 23 and 24, and it has to do with the viability of a release signed by the plaintiff. And the court said that the release was not specific enough to relieve Chevron, as a matter of law, from liability for plaintiff's mesothelioma. The court wrote, we conclude that Chevron has not met its burden to demonstrate the absence of any material question of fact. The 1997 release does not unambiguously extinguish a future claim for mesothelioma. The release itself does not mention mesothelioma. It does say that Mr. South is giving up the right to bring an action against the released parties or any of them in the future for any new or different diagnosis that may be made about claimant's condition as a result of exposure to any product. But the term claimant's condition may cabin the new or different diagnosis to ones that related to his non-malignant asbestos-related pulmonary disease, the only condition he suffered from at the time the release was signed. Next is the Kukovic case, C-U-K-O-V-I-Q, on pages 24 and 25. It's a traffic accident case involving a rental vehicle, and it involves the Graves Amendment, which applies to rental vehicles. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that Nissan's motion to dismiss the complaint should have been granted pursuant to the Graves Amendment. The court said, under the Graves Amendment, in order for recovery to be barred, the owner or an affiliate of the owner must be engaged in the trade or business of renting or leasing motor vehicles, and the owner or its affiliate must not be negligent. Here, the Nissan defendants demonstrated that they were the owners of the vehicle and were engaged in the business of renting or leasing motor vehicles. Additionally, to the extent that the plaintiff's theory of negligent maintenance or mechanical malfunction was supported by factual allegations, the Nissan defendants established that the allegations were not facts at all through its submissions showing that the Nissan defendants never possess, inspect, repair, maintain, or service the vehicles they lease, and that it was the sole responsibility of the lessee of the subject vehicle to maintain that vehicle. In Carthen, the next case on page 25, the First Department reversing Supreme Court. It's another traffic accident case. There was a two-justice dissent, and the First Department made the unusual finding that testimony did not raise a question of fact in this traffic accident case because it was incredible as a matter of law. The defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. The court said, although we agree with the dissent that as a general premise, the contradictions in the testimony of the respective parties raise issues of credibility for the trier of fact to resolve, there are rare instances where credibility is properly determined as a matter of law. This court is not required to shut its eyes to the patent falsity of a claim. Here, we conclude that plaintiff's deposition testimony was demonstrably false and should be rejected as incredible as a matter of law, permitting summary judgment in favor of defendant. The next case, another traffic accident case, Young, On page 26, it's a motorcycle accident, raised several issues. Plaintiff was a it's a second department case. Plaintiff was a passenger on a motorcycle that collided with a van which attempted to make a left turn across the motorcycle's path. The court held, one, plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment against the van driver who violated vehicle and traffic law 1146 and 1126 in making the turn. Two, the van driver's employer was vicariously liable because the driver was operating the van during the course of his employment. The employer leased the van for more than 30 days and therefore was the owner of the van under vehicle and traffic law 388. Three, the Graves Amendment may insulate the lessor of the van from liability. And four, plaintiff was not a covered person under the no-fault provisions of the insurance law and therefore did not have to demonstrate serious injury before bringing suit. Next is the Santana case on pages 26 and 27. It's a traffic accident case involving a police car and a pedestrian. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the reckless standard applied in this pedestrian police car traffic accident case. The court wrote, here a factual issue exists as to whether defendants were engaged in a protected activity under Vehicle and Traffic Law 1104B, namely proceeding past a steady red signal, see Vehicle and Traffic Law 1104B2, while pursuing a vehicle for a traffic violation, so as to apply the reckless standard of care as opposed to ordinary negligence principles. Next case is another traffic accident case involving municipal law and emergency vehicles. It's the Howell case on page 27. The Third Department, reversing the Court of Claims, held that the snowplow driver was not liable in this case. The highway work exemption from standard negligence applied, and the driver was not reckless. The court said there is little dispute that the Court of Claims erred in applying Vehicle and Traffic Law 1104, which affords certain privileges to the driver of an authorized emergency vehicle when involved in an emergency operation, and has no applicability to a vehicle such as a snowplow put to its intended use. The pertinent statute, instead, is Vehicle and Traffic Law 1103B, which exempts from the rules of the road all vehicles which are actually engaged in work on a highway and imposes on such vehicles a reckless standard of care. The next and last case is Buchanan on page 27, I believe. No, it's on page 28, traffic accident case, rear-end collision. The Second Department held that plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment in this rear-end collision traffic accident case, noting that the plaintiff no longer has to demonstrate freedom from comparative fault to warrant a judgment on liability. The court wrote, the plaintiff testified that her vehicle was stopped at a red light when it was struck in the rear by defendant's vehicle. The testimony established that defendant's driver's negligence was approximate cause of the accident. Plaintiff also submitted a transcript of the defendant driver's deposition testimony, but that testimony does not present a triable issue of fact. The defendant driver testified that before the accident occurred, the light turned green and plaintiff began to slowly move forward. The defendant driver began to accelerate, then he saw plaintiff's brake lights go on. He testified that he hit the brakes and hit her. In essence, his testimony amounted to a claim that plaintiff's vehicle came to a sudden stop, which, standing alone, was insufficient to rebut the presumption of negligence on the part of defendant. So this concludes the CLE course based upon the negligence-related decisions that were released in February 2019. The course entitles you to one-half credit, 0.5 credit hours, and includes one verification code.